Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons and in the market daily with them that met with him. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him. And some said, "What will this babbler say?" Others some, "He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection." And they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, saying, "May we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is? For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know therefore what these things mean." For all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. So verses 10 to 15 is the previous episode that we looked at this morning. It recounts Paul's visit to the city of Berea after that he had essentially escaped from Thessalonica. And the Jews in Berea were considered more open-minded than those in Thessalonica. And in fact, Paul found a much better reception among the Jews in Berea than what he did in Thessalonica. And he saw many more of them come to faith. There's a contrast there between the two groups. The Jews in Thessalonica, there were some that believed. Many of them rejected and opposed Paul. In Berea, there were many of them that believed and some that did not. And perhaps they joined with those that came from Thessalonica later in their opposition of Paul. But trouble comes in Berea as there are some of the unbelieving Jews from Thessalonica come to Berea to stir up the people in the city and to try to prosecute Paul, much like they had there in Thessalonica, though they were unsuccessful. Now, the believers in Berea react very quickly when they find out what's going on, and they send some of their number to conduct Paul out of town before there's any sort of a public scene like happened in Thessalonica. And they go with him, Luke tells us, all the way to Athens, and probably about 300 miles. And then once they get to Athens, Paul sends them back to Berea with a message for Silas and Timothy to come to him as soon as possible. Now, the rest of the chapter here in 17 is about Paul's time in Athens. And while Paul is waiting for his companions to arrive in Athens, he begins speaking with the Jews and the Greeks in the city. And ultimately, he ends up coming before a city council of sorts, but in a different way than what he has done before. So we want to look at this section, which is really an introductory section that sets up Paul's speech or sermon before this council, which takes up most of the chapter, and then their reaction to it is which is in the end of the chapter. So we're looking at this introductory section. In verses 16 to 18, we have an account of Paul in Athens as he's moving about and what he's doing there. And in verses 19 to 21, we have the account of Paul being taken to the Areopagus. So let's begin with verse number 16. "Now while Paul waited for them at Athens, his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry." Now it's not clear at this point what Paul's plan was. We know that when he was in Macedonia, he was no doubt intending to stay in Macedonia. He goes from Philippi to Thessalonica. He comes to Berea. How much of that was planned beforehand? It doesn't seem clear that it was. But now he has left the province of Macedonia. He's gone to the province of Achaia, which is where Athens is. We're also the city of Corinth, which he will go to after he leaves Athens. And so it's just not clear. We saw earlier in this missionary journey that he would attempt to go into Asia and would not be permitted. He would try to go into Bithynia and would not be permitted. Essentially, he would be pushed west into Macedonia. And here we don't have any indications other than the events that unfold in each of these places. So I don't think it would be proper for us to say, well, Paul came to Athens by accident. Knowing Paul, I don't have any doubt of what Paul wanted to get to Athens, as well as he wanted to get to a lot of other places that he would just probably never live long enough to get to. But nevertheless, through the providence of God and through the working of the Spirit and through the events that have unfolded, Paul is indeed in Athens. But Paul is alone in Athens, and he's waiting for Timothy and Silas, and he has no definite idea of when they are going to arrive. It was a considerable journey. He didn't know for sure how long things might take there in Berea before they would leave, and so it's a little bit uncertain. So here in the city of Athens, Athens was an ancient city, a city that had its glory peak, or what sometimes is referred to as its golden age or golden days, about 500 years earlier than when Paul had made it to Athens. Its peak was ended in wars with Persia and Sparta, where the city was nearly destroyed. It wasn't entirely, but he would go on to be rebuilt. But Athens would never quite recapture the glory that it had known prior to that time. So in Paul's day, when he comes to Athens, there were certainly larger cities than Athens within the Roman Empire. There were certainly wealthier cities than Athens in the empire. But there were not many cities that were more well known or had the history and reputation and tradition that the city of Athens had. Athens had a rich history, and it was still a leading city in philosophy and education and art and sophisticated culture. And I've seen people to try to compare Athens to modern day cities, and I'm just not really sure what modern day city would really compare with Athens. We might think of modern day cities with rich histories, and they seem to be famous for a number of things, but in many ways, Athens is considered really the foundation of Western civilization and Western culture as we know it today. It's hard to overemphasize the influence that Athens had in the realms of education and mathematics and art and architecture and all the various aspects of philosophy and all of these things, and some of the most famous contributions throughout history were made by Athenians. So it's just hard to really try to figure out what modern city would be like this. But nevertheless, Paul is at Athens, which was certainly one of the most well-known and one of the most important cities of the world at that time. Now, Luke reports here that Paul was provoked, or he was stirred up within himself. It says his spirit was stirred in him when he saw the city wholly given to idolatry. The word that Luke uses here, I understand, is a very rare Greek word that this about the city wholly given to idolatry. It's essentially the term means that the city was covered in idols. I've heard it described in various ways, like it was a forest of idols. It was overgrown or overrun with idols, or submerged in idols, and all of these type of descriptions. A city wholly given to idols. So here was Paul in a place of renowned philosophy and architecture and the arts and sculptural arts and what have you, where all of those disciplines, all of those skills, all of those achievements, Paul could see was being employed in the service of false gods. For all of the accomplishments and all of the advancements and everything that Athens had contributed to the Hellenistic culture, it was all being employed in the service of false gods. I have read that that Athens was literally filled with temples and with shrines and with altars, and that there were statues and images all over the city. Images of Athena and Apollo and Jupiter and Venus and Mercury and Neptune and Bacchus and Diane and all the gods of Olympus. The images that were there were images that were made out of stone and out of marble and out of ivory and out of brass and silver and gold, and some of them very large. I've read that the gleam off of the tip of the spear of Diana, I believe it was, or no, the statue to Athena, stood so tall that it could be seen from 40 miles away from Athens. So it was a city that was just completely covered up in idols and images. I've read that some historians' comments about Athens of the day is that all of Athens was an altar. That the whole city was essentially a temple or an altar, a place of sacrifice to the gods. And of course, one of the maybe humorous or sarcastic comments about Athens historically was that it was easier to find a god in Athens than it was to find a man. Verse 17. Therefore disputed he in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons, and in the market daily with them that met with him. So Paul was in a new city alone, and he was stirred up and provoked within himself by their idolatry. Now it's not clear if Paul was perhaps planning to wait until Timothy and Silas joined him before he began evangelizing in the city of Athens. I don't see any reason to doubt that what Paul intended to evangelize the city of Athens while he was there. But Paul typically did not work alone. Always had at least one companion with him. It's very rare instances where you find him alone. And usually those are certainly circumstances that are out of his control. But either way, Paul did set about this work by himself here in Athens. Now Luke records that there were two main places of witness that Paul went to, and three main groups of people that Paul addressed in those places. First of all, it says that he disputed in the synagogue with the Jews and with the devout persons. So the first place that he went was to the synagogue in Athens, and no doubt on the Sabbath day. Now we have already seen that that was Paul's custom, that was his manner of working. He would establish contact with the Jewish community, particularly in a synagogue on the Sabbath day, if they had a synagogue there. And Luke says here that he disputed with them. And the word means to discuss or to argue. That he debated with them. He had conversation. There's back and forth with them in the synagogue. Now again, we know from what we've already seen of Luke in the book of Acts and what he's written to us about Paul, we know the substance of what Paul's argument was from the past episodes that we've looked at. He is speaking to the Jews and to those God-fearing Gentiles in the synagogue, and he's arguing from the Old Testament that Jesus is the promised Messiah, and he's proclaiming salvation by faith in his name alone. We know that that's the substance of what he is disputing with them, of what is the meaning of this word revealed through the prophets, and how that Jesus of Nazareth fulfilled these prophecies in his life, and what that means for the future, and what that means for what we should do now. At the synagogue, he was addressing the same two groups of people that he typically did, the Jews that were gathered there, and here he says the devout persons. And this would be a reference again to those Gentiles that were sort of known by a nickname as God-fearers. They were not full proselytes to Judaism, but they were indeed sympathetic to Judaism. They devoted at least some study to the Jewish, the Hebrew scriptures. They would attend the synagogue on the Sabbath day. They would take part in certain rites and feasts and what have you. They were at least sympathetic. So we notice with this group of people, the Jews and these God-fearing Gentiles, one of the things to notice about them is that they would have had a background of knowledge of the Old Testament scriptures. And that certainly affected the way that Paul spoke to them. Now, even when we talk about Paul going into the synagogue, and we've seen samples of his preaching in the synagogues, and if you compare that, for instance, say, to Peter on the day of Pentecost, or Peter even at the temple after healing the lame man at the gate, you're certainly going to notice some differences, but you're also going to notice that the substance of those messages are the same. Chiefly, the only difference is when Peter or the others were addressing Jews within Israel at that time, they were directly charging them with the murder of Jesus Christ. Now, when Paul is speaking some two decades later to Jews outside of Jerusalem, and Jews who likely had not been to Jerusalem or certainly were not there at the time, he's not directly charging them with the murder of Jesus Christ, but nevertheless, he is showing them what the death of Jesus Christ meant and his burial and his resurrection and how this was according to the Old Testament scriptures. He's the Messiah promised. And still yet the message is the same, that they must repent and believe in him in order to have salvation. In order to have, as he put it in Antioch of Pisidia, in order to be justified from all of the things that they could not be justified by the law of Moses. So we know that the substance of that message is the same. And it does affect the way that Paul is speaking to them, because they do have some knowledge and some acquaintance with the Old Testament scriptures. But Paul went also to another place. It says in verse 17, "And in the market daily with them that met with him." He went to the common market. A Greek word there, the agora, is what is being spoken of. And he went there day by day. So the picture that Luke is painting for us is that he was going to the synagogue on the Sabbath days, and he's speaking to the Jews and the Gentiles that are there. And from day to day throughout the week, he's going to the agora. He's going to the marketplace there in Athens. The agora was sort of a town square. It was a place where there was business that was transacted. There would be buying and selling that would take place. There would be a public marketplace. It was also a place of public assemblies where certain votes might be taken or certain decisions might be arrived at. Various reasons could be had for that. But the agora in Athens was also a place that was common for speeches and lectures and teaching by the various philosophers and the various disciples of the various philosophers, things that would be going on all of the time. Now, what we have to understand about the Greek culture in this day is that it was still largely an oral culture. All right, so the Greeks had been writing for centuries. Way back, I think 8th century BC or something, when the Greek alphabet was formed. They've been writing for centuries, but they still put the preeminence on speaking. Logic and rhetoric and oral teaching. So they had been writing for centuries, but even their writing was done with the intention of it being read aloud. For instance, if you look at any of the earliest copies of any parts of the New Testament scriptures, you would see what is Greek, but it would be Greek letters, all uppercase, with no spaces between words and no punctuation. These were things that were added much later as the development of writing came on. These were things that were later added more to aid the reading than they were the speaking. See, even what was written by the Greeks was intended to be spoken. That was the point of it. So what I'm saying is, so this agora was a cultural center. All right, people weren't locked away in their bedrooms and living rooms, you know, playing on their phones and iPads and what have you, or watching a TV. They were going to the marketplace and would listen. No, accounts I've seen for hours, they would listen to speeches. They would listen to philosophers giving lectures. They would listen to those speaking and maybe a couple of philosophers engaging in a dialogue. And Plato was certainly famous for his dialogues. So the agora was a cultural center. It was sort of a social media before there was ever any sort of electronic technology. It's where everyone went to hear and to see the latest things. Now today we just can search up on YouTube and see whatever the latest viral video is. But in that day, people actually physically went to the agora in the city to listen to those that were speaking. All right, so Paul goes to this place, to this agora, this marketplace, this town square, this city center. And he goes there, and Luke notes that he spoke there daily with them that met with him. In other words, whoever happened to come by and would engage with Paul in conversation, he would speak with them. Now, Luke later notes in verse 21 how the Athenians were caught up in the incessant pursuit of the new or the latest. And so it's not hard to imagine Paul finding an audience. In other words, if nothing else, he would be able, no doubt, to attract some simply by the novelty of the things that he was speaking about. Because Paul was in this agora speaking about things that the people there had never heard about, had no knowledge of. Jesus and the resurrection, all of these things. So it's easy to understand how Paul could gather around him those that would be interested. Now, Luke does not record here any reaction or any response from the Jews in the synagogue. No doubt the response was similar to what we've seen Paul experience in other places. There was maybe some that believed. Maybe there was many that believed. There were others that did not believe and those that opposed. I don't doubt that that is exactly what Paul experienced there as well. But Luke's purpose here with Paul in Athens is obviously to focus on the pagans in Athens and the message that Paul speaks to them and the response that he gets from them. So the language that Luke uses here in verse 17 about meeting in the market daily and so on, and his disputing, whatever the tense of the words that's used, indicates that this went on for a while. We don't know how long, but it went on for a while. It wasn't just that Paul went to the marketplace for a few minutes and then these philosophers accosted him. This seemed to have gone on for at least some time. Verse 18. Then certain philosophers of the Epicureans and of the Stoics encountered him. And some said, "What will this babbler say?" Others, "He seemeth to be a setter forth of strange gods, because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection." So Paul encountered certain philosophers, certainly very, very leading philosophers of the day, philosophies that had a strong following, the Epicureans and the Stoics. The Epicureans were followers of the philosophy of Epicurus. Epicurus died somewhere around 270 BC, so he had been dead for nearly 300 years by this time. The Epicureans believed that the gods of the supernatural realm were aloof and unconcerned about the lives of mortals on earth. In other words, there was no supernatural involvement or interference or anything at all. The gods took no notice of mere mortals up on earth. They did not believe in an afterlife. The Epicureans thought that all ended after death. No afterlife, no future judgment, no punishment or reward in the afterlife for deeds done in this life. None of that. They thought it all ended at death. Their life philosophy was to live for pleasure and to avoid pain as much as possible. So in other words, you could sort of sum it up as saying, life is what it is. That's all that there is. So you may as well do your best, enjoy life as much as you can. Certainly avoid things that are going to cause pain or discomfort. And once you die, you're just dead like a dog. He also encountered the Stoics. Now, the Stoics were a rival school of philosophy to the Epicureans. They were followers of the philosophy of Zeno. Zeno was a philosopher that died about the same time, 265 BC, somewhere in there. Again, he'd been dead for nearly 300 years. And the Stoics denied the supernatural or spiritual reality. They did believe, they had a concept of a supreme God, but they believed that that God was in and through all nature. Today we refer to that as pantheism. But God was just in all and through all living things. They believed that emotions were false and that they were to be avoided. Emotions were not true to reality, and so they were to be stifled. And you know, the sort of the picture that you have, if you refer to someone as being stoic, typically you're describing them as being emotionless, as just really showing no reaction or being unaffected by anything that happens to them in life. They believed that suffering was good because it was owing to fate. And they did have a view of fate. They believed in fate, but it was an impersonal fate. It wasn't any sort of a divine being or deity that determined any course of events. Stoics were skeptical about any sort of a permanent afterlife. They denied any sort of a permanent afterlife. It's a little unclear as to exactly what they thought happened after you died, or when these things happened after you died, but that ultimately they held to what we would know today as more of an annihilationism. That after you died, yes, there would be some sort of a spiritual continuance, but that ultimately would just cease to exist altogether. Didn't really believe in any thought of heaven or hell or anything like that. The Stoics were taught to accept things as they are, and that the only way to find happiness in life was to live in accordance with nature. And they were big believers in nature and reason. So these were obviously two leading and rival schools of philosophy, very dominant in Athens and the Greek culture in that day. And so there were certain philosophers of these schools that encountered Paul as he's there in the Agora. And so they began to question him or enter into a conversation with him. Some of them said, "What will this babbler say?" Now, the word for babbler here literally means seed picker. And essentially, as best I understand it, it was a metaphorical term that was used to describe someone who was a plural plagiarist. All right, so the image would be like that of a bird that's just flitting about from place to place and just picking up a little bit here and a little bit there and so on. And so this would be a term that would describe someone who was just sort of creating a hodgepodge of philosophy by taking little bits and scraps from various philosophers, various teachers, and they would sort of gather those together into their philosophy. And essentially it was an insult. It was describing one who was not an original thinker. It was respectable to have been tutored by a certain philosopher, but it was ultimately desirable, as I understand it, for a philosopher to have sort of developed their own system. So calling Paul a babbler or a seed picker is basically calling him, this is a scavenger. In other words, it might be similar to referring to someone as a hack today. Someone that just simply takes the work of others and, you know, messes it up a little bit or adds just a little bit of something and then tries to pass it off as their own. So this is what they were saying about Paul. Notice it says that there were others that said, he seems to be setting forth strange or foreign gods. They thought that he was speaking about gods that were not known or that were not worshipped in Athens. Now Luke adds this explanation at the end of verse 18. Because he preached unto them Jesus and the resurrection. So Luke is indicating to us here that those were foreign concepts to those philosophers that Paul was talking to. He's not just saying that they were rejectors of Jesus and the resurrection. They were saying that Jesus and the resurrection was something unknown to them. That was something entirely different than they had encountered or experienced before. Now Paul uses the word here, this word for preached, is the word euangelizo. It's the word that we get our word evangelize from. It's a word that means not just to preach, but it's a word that means to announce good news. Because he was announcing the good news of Jesus and the resurrection. So in other words, though we don't know exactly what Paul was preaching to them, and we have no reason to doubt that his approach was probably somewhat different than he took with the Jews. He probably was not beginning with that common foundation of the Old Testament Scriptures, though he obviously was referring to the Old Testament Scriptures, and that becomes evident in what follows. But nevertheless, he's declaring to them the good news about Jesus and the resurrection, obviously meaning the necessity of faith and repentance and the promise of salvation and the, no doubt even the prophecy given that God is the creator of the world and so on. And we'll see more about that again as we go on. But the last part of this, beginning in verse 19, and they took him and brought him unto Areopagus, saying, may we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is? The Areopagus was a council that was named for the Hill of Aris, which is what Areopagus literally means, Hill of Aris. It would be more commonly known to us as Mars Hill, would be the translation there. Apparently, the council had historically held much power. But by this time, the Areopagus Council was more of a consulting and deliberating body without a lot of actual formal authority. Now, particularly this council, as I understand it historically, was concerned about issues of education and religion in Athens. They were very concerned about things that were being taught within the city of Athens. Now, Paul was brought there to be questioned about what he was teaching. And if indeed he was teaching some new religion, if indeed he was teaching some new philosophy that included some new gods that was unknown to them, he would very probably need the approval of this council in order to continue teaching that in Athens. In other words, he would need to be approved by the city council. So the question that's asked him here, may we know what this new doctrine whereof thou speakest is? It's not put in the form of a public accusation or charge. So if we look at other incidents in the book of Acts where Paul or maybe others are brought before some sort of a council and they are accused of some sort of crime or wrongdoing under the threat of punishment if they're found guilty, we find that the language there is a little bit different. So the council here very likely doesn't have the authority of itself to punish Paul, but it does have the feel of a public hearing. They're questioning Paul about what the new doctrine was that he was teaching or speaking about. This continues in verse 20. "For thou bringest certain strange things to our ears. We would know thereof what these things mean." Now again, it's the same way here with the language of the way that this question is put. It's not put in the form of any sort of a public accusation or legal charge. It's put more in the form of an investigative question. They wanted an explanation of exactly what Paul was teaching. Now this also seems to continue the idea that we saw in the previous verse, that there was some confusion over what Paul was teaching. That there was some misunderstanding. They hadn't quite grasped what Paul was teaching. And again, that's probably because it was so new and foreign to them that they didn't really understand. And if you read sometimes the biographies or the historical accounts of missionaries going into cultures that have been unreached cultures, you see this playing out. Because as they begin to, they have to learn to communicate with those of this culture, and then they have to begin to speak to them about God and about Christ and about sin and about salvation and heaven and hell and all of these things. And a lot of times there's confusion within these cultures about what exactly this message is, because it's something so new and foreign to them. And oftentimes missionaries will attempt to what is called contextualize, which means they will try to find certain things within those cultures, certain ethics, certain thoughts, certain ideas about maybe about the supernatural world, or maybe about the afterlife, or maybe about the nature of our being, the terms of creation, how all things came to be, that sort of thing. They will try to find certain aspects of that that they can liken and approach and speak to them. So there was some confusion here about what Paul was saying, and the council is asking for a clear declaration of what exactly it is that Paul is teaching. Now, this council may not have had extensive authority, and it doesn't seem that they did, but Paul's teaching may have been illegal in the city of Athens, and they certainly would want to know that if that was the case. Not only that, the council did probably have the ability to come to a decision that could refer Paul up to a higher court, so to speak, that would have the authority to put him to a public trial with the possibility of threat of certain punishment if he were indeed found guilty of some sort of illegal teaching in Athens. And in verse 21, "For all the Athenians and strangers which were there spent their time in nothing else, but either to tell or to hear some new thing." Luke adds this observation about the Athenians. And actually, as you go through the book of Acts, you'll see that this sort of a parenthetical statement is rare. It's just not something that Luke does real often. And there are a number of different ideas about why he puts this here. Now, first of all, we would say that Luke's assessment of the Athenians in this day is very much in line as well with historical assessments of the Athenians. That it certainly was a place where people were consumed with hearing some new thought, some original idea, some innovative philosophy. They were forever chasing the latest fads. As I read this account and the context in which this statement comes, I really believe that Luke is giving this explanation here as a way of explaining that it's one of the functions of the council, the Areopagus Council, that it's one of the functions of that council to vet new ideas and new philosophies and new religions that were being taught in Athens. Is this, in other words, is this something that is going to be added to the plural collection of philosophies and gods and whatnot that they have in Athens? Is this something that is going to be deemed to be actually illegal and therefore not receive approval of the teaching, or maybe even be referred to some higher body of authority? Nevertheless, this was the case in Athens as Paul began to preach the good news of Jesus Christ there. All right, so this episode sets up the last missionary sermon in the book of Acts, and the only one in the book of Acts to be to a thoroughly pagan Gentile audience. So we've seen samples of what was preached to what you might call Orthodox Jews in Jerusalem. We've seen samples of what was preached to those Samaritans, which were sort of half-breed Jews with a blended form of, and sort of their own form of Judaism. We've seen what the message was that was preached to Gentiles who were God-fearers and who had some knowledge of the Old Testament and some acquaintance with Judaism and obviously some sympathies in that direction. We've seen samples of what that looks like in all those cases, and now Luke has set up what it looked like to preach this message to a thoroughly pagan audience. Again, an audience that had no knowledge of this message, no history with it. I would also say, as we talk about Athens, it's hard, I think, to miss the similarity to cultures that we see in the world today, and even our own increasingly secular society. It almost seems to me that we as a society are ready to embrace anything and everything, no matter how irrational, illogical, and absurd that it is, as long as it's not Jesus Christ and the God, the Creator God of the universe. As long as it's not that, we're ready to swallow anything and everything else that comes to us. Our society is completely consumed with seeking after self-help philosophies, wanting to find what's the newest, latest innovation in self-help philosophies, the latest therapies, the latest psychologies. We are covered up, maybe not with the statues and images that Paul saw in Athens, and the temples and the shrines, although I do believe we have those. They're just of a different sort, just of a little bit different character. But we are certainly a society and culture that is covered up with the idolatry of humanism. No question about that. So what I'm saying is, this account is obviously an important one for us to learn from in the day that we live, in the secular society that we find ourselves in, as well as many places in what might be called the developed world.